guys, welcome to Not Another Anxiety Show. I'm your host, Kelly Walker, and joining me today is guest Dr. Sarah Sarkis. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks so much for hopping back on the show again.
It's so good to be back. It was too long.
We do. We love having you, and I always get emails and requests for Sarah to come back on.
Oh, well, that makes me feel very special.
Yeah. Now, even though you've been here before, do you mind if I share a little bit more about you with our listeners?
Of course. Yeah, please.
Wonderful. Dr. Sarkis is a licensed psychologist living in Honolulu, Hawaii. Originally hailing from Boston, Mass., yay, she has a private practice where she works with adults in long-term insight-oriented therapy. Dr. Sarkis earned her master's from Boston College and doctorate from George Washington University. She approaches psychological wellness from a holistic and integrative perspective. Her therapeutic style is based on an integrative approach to wellness, where she blends her strong psychodynamic and insight-oriented training with more traditionally behavior and or mind-body techniques to help patients foster insight, change, and growth. Dr. Sarkis studied extensively the use of mindfulness, functional medicine, hormones, and how food, medicine, and mood are interconnected. Dr. Sarkis is also a writer. You can check out her blog, The Padded Room, on her website, www.drsarahsarkis.com. So, Sarah, today we're going to chat about two separate but inherently related concepts known as epigenetics and neuroplasticity, which are just two fancy words for saying you can teach an old dog new tricks, right? Kind of like the title of your blog there.
Exactly. Yeah, I love that title because it's true. It's like these are the concepts that we start to really realize, oh, wow, I am in fact at the helm of this ship.
Yeah, which can be really empowering.
Yeah, and horrifying all at the same time. Yeah. Anybody that hears that and gets a little bit nervous, I am with you.
Yep, it's like, yay, I have a say in my destiny, but
oh
crap,
shit.
I have a say in my destiny.
Oh my God, what now? I'm responsible for me?
Yeah, what now?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I know the field of psychology, as young as it is, it has been based on this assumption that the brain stops growing and changing in early adulthood and that genes are just predestined, our fate to our wellness. But, you know, as you know, and you share in your blog, more recent research suggests otherwise. What do we now understand about the brain and our genes?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would expand that pretty much, I think all of medicine sort of begins the formation, right? And psychology, of course, probably fell into that because we were also in this mad scramble to be seen as like a hard science, right? Back in the day versus a soft science, right? So we were like, okay, like that's the motto, right? But the reality is actually quite different. And I'm no like historian on this, but people that are interested in kind of the period of time leading up to when it became much more conclusive, as it always is, there's a really good story in there of like cover-ups and scandals.
Scandalous.
And like epidemic, you know, competition, and ultimately
a lot of biases,
You know, what reigned supreme was this notion that you're saying that, you know, things were inflexible. You basically reached kind of 25. And after that, it was all downhill. You were, you know, on the back nine and kind of waiting for one deterioration to happen after the other, right? And I say in the essay that these beliefs were cracked wide open. They sort of crystallized. Although there's like a lot of speculation, there's like people all the way back into like the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s really talking about neuroplasticity. But around the early 2000s, when the Human Genome Project concluded and a cluster of neurologists started to really, I believe it was through the study of stroke victims, really be able to conclusively say that actually our brain has plasticity throughout a lifetime and that your genes are really one slice of your overall destiny. And, you know, if you listen to like Mark Hyman, he would say, I think the statistic that he's comfortable with is that it's only 10% of your destiny. Yeah. So it's actually a very, very small percentage, and all the bulk of the other factors of that pie are completely within our control.
Can you give some examples?
Diet,
yeah.
Sleep, stress management. And that's the one, as a psychologist, although, you know, as a street scientist, I like to talk about anything under the sun, but as a trained psychologist, I am, you know, encouraged to stay in my lane. That's the area that I really work with my patients. And then I refer out for these other things, but diet, sleep, stress, exercise, environmental toxins, can't always control that, but there's a lot we can do. And overall inflammation levels in the body, that's mediated. That can be heavily influenced by diet and stress reduction. So though that's just a few of the things that are really inside of our control.
Yeah. And can you give us like a layman's description of what this term epigenetics means? Basically, it sounds like what you're saying is, hey, we have some degree of control over how our DNA is expressed, or if, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but go ahead and.
No, that's perfect. And I know that I secretly know off of our podcast relationship that you're an epigenetics nerd. Yeah. So
I am going to share one of my favorite epigenetic studies in just moment.
But I'm so glad, because you know I'll go geek out on it afterward. Epigenetics is this understanding that you can influence your epigenome. So the distinction that I think is important for anybody listening who sort of likes science but doesn't want to like geek out with us, here's the important distinction. You can't actually change your genes. They are hardwired into you.
You get what you get, right?
It's like height, eye color, all that stuff, and including disease expression, is wired into us as a blueprint. But what you can influence is the epigenome, this layer on top of your DNA. And that's like the gatekeeper. It's the series of steps that have to happen in order for the gene expression to get unlocked. And the epigenome is incredibly malleable and influenced by our lifestyle choices, like we were just talking about, sleep, the diet, the exercise, dealing with stress and trauma, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where all the power is. It's in the epigenome. It's in that really malleable relationship that we have with it. Yeah. We don't know that we have it till we know it, right? But you're influencing it all the time, and it is in flux all the time.
Yes, I think that's so important. It's dynamic, right?
Like depending, it is dynamic.
Depending what's happening in our lives, like it's dynamic. And that also can be helpful, right? If we're going through a rough season, if we've had a lot of loss, or we've been particularly sick, right? Or we've been particularly busy and some of these like lifestyle factors have fallen by the side. It's dynamic. It's something that we can influence and can shift and change.
Yes, really you can. And actually, if any of the listeners are sort of involved with any functional medicine people, or even with a general practitioner where you're really like, they're saying, hey, we want to see your cholesterol come down, I'd urge you to see that that's an epigenetic study of an N of one. So you then make changes in your lifestyle, diet, meditate, get better sleep, drink more water, cut down on it, right? All the things we know. And you go get tested 3 months later. That's only 90 days. Most people are going to see that their cholesterol will go down. Most people, right? That's an epigenetic research study you just did on yourself.
On yourself. Yep, exactly.
You know, and we're all N's of one, right? So, but yeah, this is a really, it is, the body is super forgiving.
Yeah, resilient, right? It's more resilient than we often, I know a lot of us stuck in the throes of anxiety, kind of see ourselves as really fragile and glass, and we underestimate this resiliency that's working, it's working in our favor, especially if we're at all supportive to our bodies and to ourselves.
Yeah. Being kind.
Yeah.
Being, having this notion, and I'm not like a, you know, I'm not like a hashtag namaste kind of gal. I'm grittier than that. So what I'm about to say is shockingly namaste, but this notion of how powerful just self-compassion is. Like, can you take care of yourself? Can you be gentle to the parts of yourself that do feel fragile? And can you approach it like you would if that was a child?
Yep. It's funny you say that. We just had an episode like, how would you support an anxious child, and kind of applying it to ourselves? Like, how would you support a child? And it's funny because it leads kind of right into this study that I wanted to share super briefly. But we do see, right, when we're kind to ourselves or just show ourselves some caring, we see physiological changes from that. And this study comes from Massachusetts General Hospital, and it found that incorporating mindfulness, and that can be a self-compassion mindfulness, it can be, you know, a loving kindness, it could be just a regular your breath mindfulness meditation, but incorporating this mindfulness meditation not only relieved symptoms of IBS and IBD, but it reduced the expression of a number of genes directly linked to the inflammatory process that drives both IBS and IBD. So it's, you know, just like your example with cholesterol, that's us influencing our epigenetics.
That's such a good study. Can you send that to me?
I absolutely can.
As an aside, that's awesome. And I mean, this is like what I see in my practice and my work with people, you know, all day long, and that the body is actually very responsive fairly quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it wants to be in homeostasis. That is,
it wants to be in balance. That takes the least amount of effort, right?
Exactly. So, I love that they are studying that really sort of like conclusively, especially because they're such a hardcore, medical institute. So it's like just awesome.
I know.
Tides are changing. I do love it.
I know. They are changing.
I know.
And so we chatted about epigenetics, and can you give us the layman kind of definition of what we understand around neuroplasticity now, what it is exactly?
Yeah, neuroplasticity is sort of exactly as it sounds. It is the realization that actually your brain has plasticity and flexibility throughout its lifespan, and that the best predictor of ongoing flexibility of your brain is practice.
Yeah.
So just keep doing new novel things. You bring more connectivity and plasticity to parts of your brain that were previously inactive. And you can, when it comes to the explicit relationship that it has in my line of work, is that we can change really long held patterns of thought. That's our cognitive life, of how those thoughts influence our feelings. We can change these patterns that we identify throughout maturation, or in my case, in the therapy process, as say self-sabotaging or just unproductive. We can change them.
Yeah, it's, or not rumination, like, right? Like,
yes, rumination, worry, our responses to fear, all kinds of things that, because our neurobiology is so complex that, and it's so layered, you know, it's like every experience is a layer added on to that neurobiological patterning that we have. And that's why psychology is really, it's the most fascinating aspect to study, because it is really as unique as every fingerprint.
Yeah. And it's so funny. I think sometimes it's hard to see our brains this way because we take our thoughts and
personal.
Right? They feel personal to us. Like, this could never be just a habit. But really, neuroplasticity, it just explains that, right? Like, that our brain, it just rewires and reworks itself for whatever we do over and over and over again, right?
It is a meaning-making machine, completely, 100%. It is not personal. And here's the other thing about humans. You see, we got this complex set of, I mean, some people call it like moral codes. I mean it to be a religious, not right. not based in religion. But, you know, we have this other mechanism that comes into play where we also have shame. Mm-hmm. And so we have this like set of things that on the one hand, it kind of keeps us, when it works well, it kind of keeps us on the straight and narrow. And when it goes awry, it just abuses our own being, right? Yeah. So a lot of times too, what I see is that people are so afraid that what they're struggling with means they are like a shameful, bad, weak, screwed up person.
Right. Or broken.
And that just perpetuates the rigid pattern.
Yep.
And so it really does, this neutralizes it. It's a way to talk about being sapiens and the human condition that is not about, you know, your willpower or their lack of.
So personal, right?
In a way that's exactly.
In a way that's actually just quite practical. And I mean, probably most people have heard of this study. It's probably the most popular study regarding neuroplasticity. But, you know, the London taxi cab drivers, they have to remember the entire layout of the city because they drive it every day. And their brains reflect this. Their hippocampus, which is like largely responsible for spatial reasoning, is significantly larger than the average person's. It just goes to show that the brain rearranges and reorganizes itself just around how we use it. So if we're in this unknowing, innocent habit of ruminating or worrying because it's addictive, of course our brain is just going to reflect that. It's going to think, hey, I need to be used for this. So I'm going to make sure to, you know, be functional in that way. And it's, again, it's so easy to take it personal that it's some reflection of our, like you said, willpower or strength or whatever it is. And honestly, it's just habit at play in it. And I know it can feel personal, but
yeah, it's just a muscle.
Yeah, exactly.
And the more you continue to flex it, and you know, it's like, that's why I think initially therapy can be super uncomfortable for people, because you're essentially trying to observe what their patterns are and then ask them to train to their weaknesses.
Yeah.
And you're asking them to continuously do it to exhaustion, yeah. right? Which may be 3 seconds, right? Some people may really only be able to, and most of us in the beginning, you're only going to be able to handle something for a very short amount of time because.
Glad you said that, because that was definitely the case for me with working with anxiety. Like, I'm like, I can hold a space for this for like the count of 5.
Yeah. And then eventually it's 7 and eventually it's 9. And you really get to see
the shift and the change. Right?
Totally the shift. And one of the things that was sort of a helpful metaphor for myself and a lot of my people that I work with is that, you know, the brain will basically just, whatever you point it at, it's going to focus on.
Yep.
So the more you point it in a certain direction, let's say on, you know, ruminating on why somebody's wronged you. Okay. Like
my favorite. Yes,
it's going
to
go there.
That's what the shower's for. Yeah. It's going to go there.
Yeah. It's going to land exactly where you point it.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
And so I always say, like, let's try to observe where you're pointing it. Is that where you want your vessel to land? Because if it's not where you want your vessel to land, we need to help you build the flexibility to start pointing it in a direction. And to get that, you really have to get that moment of pause between stimulus and response, which is why now I've become like the touter of meditation, which is also so strange because nobody that knows me from my like regular life would say that I am like Zen.
Yeah. No, yeah, I'm with you. I am. No one would call me Zen, but I have seen, you know, for Dan Harris's 10% Happier, it's like such an appropriate title because I do see an increase in just probably happiness, but also this like emotional agility. That is what mindfulness.
It's the key.
It's the key. Like it's just this emotional agility and flexibility.
That's a really good book too. I think by an MGH, certainly a Harvard woman.
Yeah.
Emotional agility. If readers are interested in this concept of emotional dexterity, flexibility, agility. It's the key. It's like you got to learn to stand on the bar of soap that is life.
Yeah.
It's slippery, but we can get more flexible in the way that we use our brain. I mean, I'm really talking about the brain, even though I know the mind is housed there within.
Yeah. And it's so, what does neuroplasticity and epigenetics mean for those of us caught in the anxiety habit? Obviously, it sounds like it's quite empowering and hopeful, but it also means hard work, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. See, that's the sell, right? It's like, I got to always be on the sell that, and on my blog, I do this a lot because it's just sort of my personality in that format is like, this is an inside job. Yep. Like there's, and I've worked with a lot of people who are at a particular time in their life where they may need some kind of medication support, you know, with conscientious work and whatnot. But I always say like, don't kid yourself. That's not going to make this go away. Yeah. Like you're still going to have to, and when people start to like, oh, I slept 8 hours last night and I turned my phone off and I ate like a vegetable. And I'm always like, yes. And that's all great. But ultimately you have to wrestle inside yourself with the things that have become for you, you know, burdensome.
Yeah.
And that's always hard work. And by the way, so is the, you know, so is changing our diet. Changing any habit
is hard.
Is really, really hard.
It is really hard. It is really hard. We really are such creatures of habit, and just instilling a new habit takes, it's just time. So much energy, right? Energy and time. And, And it is, right? It's hard work and in a different sense than we're used to, right? Like so you mentioned this earlier, how, you know, where we place our focus is kind of just how our brain wires itself. And so it's natural, I think, that we initially place our focus toward anxiety. We just stare at anxiety. We kind of stare exactly where we don't want to go and we get like pretty consumed in it. But when we sort of bring in our values too and remember to look also where we want to go and not just what we want to avoid, right? Like not just what we want to get rid of, then we start to be able to do that that hard work of holding a space for emotions. Like, and that is like, it's a struggle at first. It's just this big internal struggle. And
And it requires getting to know ourselves
in
a way that's different than just the way that it happens when it's not a practice, you know, like self-observation is a practice just like anything else. And so, you know, what I've found is that for people that are struggling with acute anxiety or even sort of chronic low grade anxiety, there's always a unique narrative around these themes, but these two themes are present. And then there's a third one that tags on: fear and control. Mm-hmm. You might be afraid of losing control.
Yep.
You might be, you know, it'll express it differently. You may be actually out of control. You can see that oftentimes when people are really struggling with substance abuse and other self-regulatory journeys. But fear and control are always there. And then avoidance usually starts to creep in when those feelings feel unregulated to the person. Yes. And so the journey for most people around anxiety, and the journey that the inward self-observation, it's just helpful to start there. Just start to be still and quiet in your own relationship to fear and control. And like you said earlier in the hour, that may be for 10 seconds.
Yeah. It really was for me. I
But it's better than zero, right?
Yep. And that's, I remember doing a podcast episode. It's a Japanese practice when trying to instill new habits, like start with a minute, because so often so many of us come in too big, too fast, too strong. It's why most, you know, New Year's resolutions die out after, I think the average is like 2 weeks or something like that, because not willing to start small often. You know, I know I wasn't, and it wasn't until I literally just kept, it was like a Roomba hitting the same spot in the wall over and over. It wasn't until I saw how ineffective coming in with such like vast goals were, you know, that I was able to say, okay, I got to knock this down a couple of pegs. And then the wonderful thing is it gets a chance to build on itself if we just kind of lower the bar, at least starting, because this is hard. New habits are hard, and we are living a life, right? A busy life for many of us in addition to that. So to integrate it, it's like we want to keep it as simple. We want to set ourselves up for success. So if 10 seconds, like a few times a day, is what we can fit in, it is so much better than nothing. And often it's like cumulative and it'll build on itself. And when we see how those 10 seconds are helping us, it gets easier to say, okay, well, maybe I could do it for a minute, you know, like, yeah, just maybe I could do that. And we start to understand our experience better and therefore, right, tolerate it a little bit more.
Yes, totally. I mean, everything you said, the only phrase I would tweak is saying to knock it down a few pegs, right? And I guess the way that I would phrase that is it's actually just understanding how the brain works, yeah, and knowing that the brain works best in those bite-size increments. Mm-hmm. That's actually how it builds neural patterns, right?
Yeah.
And so, and to know that the bumping, the Roomba bumping into the same spot is part of it. Like,
yeah,
I wrote this recent essay, and we won't veer off, but basically if people are interested, struggling when you're doing something, well, period, in life. But like, if we're going to talk about habit formation, struggle is a built-in phase. It's the first phase,
yeah,
of a four cycle process that happens in this, in our brain. So struggle is also your learning. That's how you're making micro. Every time the Roomba bumps into the wall, it's when it backs up, it's making a micro adjustment.
Yeah, that's true.
Humans are the same way, right? Yeah. We're the same way. So yeah, I totally agree with you. And for anybody that's like type A out there, and a lot of anxiety, a lot of people struggling with anxiety are sort of either closeted perfectionists, mm-hmm, or type A's.
Yeah.
And so the thought that like, oh, I got to dumb this down for me is like, and you're not, you're just effectively understanding how the brain,
how change actually works, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
How struggle is just such an, it's such an inherent piece. If, you know, we were talking about our kids earlier, if you watch a kid learning a new skill, they get pretty frustrated. They struggle, and struggle is such an inherent part because it's a catalyst for change. And I think those of us that are perfectionist or type A's, like, we're pretty anti-struggle. We just want to be like awesome and really proficient straight off the bat here. And
yes, it's so unrealistic, right?
It's just, yeah, it's unrealistic. Just as a quick side question, what is helpful, I suppose? Like, I know for me, like, I was one of those people where I would kind of, again, set the bar a little too high and it would feel really challenging and I'd kind of readjust based on what my body was telling me. But how can we, I guess, struggle effectively is the word. Like, how do we know how to tweak that bar? Like, how do we know when it's literally just banging our head against the wall and when it's like a constructive, helpful kind of struggle?
By doing it, yeah, right? You're going to have to bump up against the wall. And when it's not working, that muscle of self-observation, it's why at this point in my career, I really hope at some point I have something more to add to this toolbox. But right now,
yeah,
the best tool for anybody is learning the skill of self-observation. Yeah. We can call it mindfulness. I don't actually like care what we call it, right? Yeah, but just sort of restful, but non-sleep time where we're present in our body,
yeah,
and in the experience of our body. If that's a minute for you, great. I'd love for you. It's a muscle like anybody else, like anything else. I'd love for everybody to get to 20 minutes a day, 10 in the morning and 10 at night. I'd take 10 minutes. Right. I mean, something's better than nothing.
And can start, like, I mean, probably the time to implement that practice is not when we're like at a 10 out of 10 on the panic scale, right? Like, start.
No, you're 10 out of 10. Yeah. What I would say is get hooked up with a good coach, therapist, social worker, somebody who's, you know, been in the trenches of acute anxiety, because your central nervous system and adrenals and the whole system that supports our central, like the central nervous system response of survival, is just on fire. And you need to take it at even tinier increments.
Yeah.
And but I'll say this, and I think I said this on the first time that we connected. Panic attacks, they feel like they're going to kill you. That's mm-hmm. number one reason anybody goes to the emergency room.
Oh, yeah.
You're either going to lose your mind or die. You're sure of it.
Yep. And so sure.
So sure. You'd like to lose your mind first so that you can stop having to experience this feeling before yes. dying.
Yes.
And, yeah. But they're super, they are really sort of won and lost with thought and breath regulation, that partnership. And it's panic attacks are really responsive to good work. So yeah, you can are. Most of the time with good work, you can cut your panic attacks down to practically none within 4 months.
Yeah.
Sounds like a long time, but it's
but
not.
For how intense they are, it's not. And I remember reading that like some of the best, of course, our medical system uses recovery rate. So I'm using this not as my own words, but like with air quotations, like, panic disorder, surprisingly, as intense and consuming and limiting as it can be, has like the best quote unquote recovery rates out
it really
of
does.
A lot of the mental
I
health
swear
challenges.
To you it does. It yeah. does. And my anecdotal, you know, I don't do research like that in my practice, but I can tell you anecdotally, I completely agree with that. It's pretty easy to essentially kind of get the behavior and the central nervous system back to a regulatory stance.
Yeah. It wants to be there, like you said earlier.
It does. It really does. And then you get to really start to see, okay, so what were the baselines? What was going on for the person in their day in and day out thought process that's the soil from which panic took off?
Right.
And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where long-term change really begins, is once the panic attacks are managed and they are totally manageable. I keep saying it because anybody who's listening and has them currently is going to feel better every time one of us says that, right?
Yep.
They're going to be
yeah.
like, oh my God, there's hope. There is, super manageable. And then you can really get down to seeing what is your sort of baseline thought process. And, you know, that gets into this other discussion about kind of how people's default mode network happens. It's why this notion of a default mode network, it's what happens when your brain, you can observe your default mode network style when your brain is not active with tasks. Mm-hmm. So inherently, when I say be in your own skin and bones, I am trying to get you familiar with your own default mode network, what's happening. Where is the monkey brain going?
Yeah.
And also, I'm trying to figure out myself, okay, who is he or she when we strip away all the busyness that keeps people distant from this stuff?
From tuning in, right? We get really good at tuning out. We get really good at it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it sounds like that's one of the best ways to start putting these concepts of like neuroplasticity and epigenetics to work, like practically just sitting in our own skin and watching.
From a psychological standpoint, 100%, right? And it's like, when you say best, I want to kind of, again, clarify, because I never want to be a snake oil salesman.
Yeah.
Best doesn't mean comfortable.
Yeah, no, it's not comfortable.
It's super uncomfortable, myself included. And you know, nowadays there's great apps. I'm sort of like, I used to be kind of like a no, sit in your skin and bones, like much more rigid about it. But then I kind of fell in love with Sam Harris's Waking Up app. Mm. So now I'm like, you know, I'm sitting there with his prompts in my ears frequently, at least, you know, I try to meditate every day, but at least 3 times a week I'm using his app. So anybody listening is going to get to benefit from the fact that now I'm going to be flexible on this. But there's tons of different choices out there that can help you begin this process. So from a psychological standpoint, really that's what therapy is. They're like, really, when the chemistry is good and the person works from this vantage point, if this is what they want to do, right? There's tons of types of therapy out there that work. This is just mine. Yeah, exactly. And, but basically I'm going to be trying to utilize this notion of exercising this muscle of observation and of self-observation. We'll just be sort of really curious about your interior world. But then there's just tons of practical stuff you can do that doesn't even require partnership with somebody else. And, you know, I put those on the blog, but like an example is just get a book on functional medicine or sort of kind of moving away from the food pyramid, just kind of like modern interpretations of how to nourish your body. Perlmutter's a really great guy. Any of Terry Wall's like non-ketogenic stuff. She's got those three layers of diets that she suggests. And like, if you're not fighting an autoimmune disease, her first layer is totally healthy. But those kinds of people, just get a book, read it, and make micro adjustments. Just start adding in week by week. Add in something from one of these books. Don't decide what you're taking out. You are much better off to crowd out the bad things, you know, in this case, the non-nutritious food, than to try to take it out first. Neurobiologically, if we just say, oh, well, I'm not taking away my croissant every day. I'm adding in a smoothie.
Keeps for a healthy relationship to our food too, because that's as much as like, as much as the foods that we're eating is like our relationship to it. And it's
lightning rod. Totally. Yeah.
Cause I think a lot of us have been in that place where we get a pretty shameful or guilt ridden relationship to our food or deprivation feeling to our food.
Yeah. And that's all stuff that like in my journey is like, that's all in my wheelhouse. That's why I have the best job on earth. Because you really do, when you start to tune somebody into this mind-body-brain connection, that's what epigenetics and neuroplasticity teaches us, that it's all connected and we have tremendous participation in how this vessel moves through planet Earth.
Yeah, that we can really affect it.
Yeah,
is,
and when...
Again, both empowering and terrifying.
And terrifying. It can be like a horrifying concept. But yeah, I mean, go to bed early. Like try to get 8 hours of sleep. When you can't, observe why not. What is getting in the way? I try to have no electronics. Like everything's on airplane mode, right? So like you're not having the electronics around you while you're sleeping.
I got rid of my clock because I noticed if I check the clock in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh God, I only slept 5 hours and now I only have, you know, two more left and the countdown begins and there's this constraint of time. And it's just like a silly little trick that helped me. Like if, sleep isn't often an issue for me, but you know, when it has been, I like take a break from peeking at the clock and it just allows me to sort of settle in and make room for, you know,
sleeplessness. Not silly at all. It's actually genius.
Yeah. And it helps me make room for the sleeplessness. And then of course, paradoxically, when I make like some room for the sleeplessness, I fall back asleep.
Fall asleep. Bingo.
The paradox
it's like,
of
oh,
control
look at, I think
at
I'm
work,
falling
right?
asleep.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's so true. It is. Yeah. And those are the micro adjustments again, showing that it's the tiny change really happens in infinitesimally small increments. It's not the huge grand gestures of like, you know,
that we'd like, or some people promise, you know?
It's... Yeah. And anybody that you're looking at on Instagram, you, the audience out there, anybody you're looking at on Instagram or any social media thing, or somebody you're comparing yourself to and thinking like, and look how they do it. And like projecting that it's just easy for them, or that it's, you know, they just decided one day to like be an ultra runner. It's just not true. That's your brain playing tricks on you. I promise.
Filling in the blanks, right? Like constructing, filling in the blanks and constructing the story from so very little.
Yeah. It's 1,000 micro decisions, just tiny micro decisions from what you're going to let your brain focus on to, you know, deciding to really metabolize whatever trauma you're contending with. And trauma is what happens inside of us, not to us, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody's got trauma. It's nothing shameful. It's just a byproduct of being human.
Yeah.
So these are all ways that you can make little micro changes to how your body is ultimately going to express its sense of wellness, both in its body, like in the physical expression of it. Because don't forget, anxiety is a physical disorder too. Anybody who's had it knows the feeling.
It's a very
feeling.
Physical experience.
Yes.
Yep.
It's visceral.
It really is. It's no wonder that so many of us like end up in the emergency room for our first panic attack, because it is, I mean, you can see those physiological changes. It's very real to those of us in the middle of it. It's very physical.
Yeah, it really is. So...
Oh, well, thank you so much for geeking out with me today.
I'm so glad that we got this done. I think every listener that's listened to our podcast has heard us say we're going to do this. So I feel good that we actually did it.
We did it.
It's in the books now, so to speak.
And I'll make sure to, you know, when I'll make sure that I make the blog you wrote about epigenetics and neuroplasticity. I'll put it in the show notes so other people can find that even after they've listened to this episode, if they want to go ahead and need a refresher. It's such a wonderful article. It's concise, to the point, clear, and super informative. So I'll make sure that everybody can click on that if they need a little bit of a refresher or want to read a little bit more.
That's awesome. Thank you. I love that.
Awesome. So that's
I'll take the, the marketing any day.
Right? Oh, so that's our episode. Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and take a minute to write a review on iTunes so that we can reach and support more people. If you're looking for more resources like one-on-one coaching, courses, or have a question you'd like answered on the show, please visit notanotheranxietyshow.com. You can also get a free ebook there by subscribing to my newsletter. And until next time, remember, be kind to yourself.